Welcome back to the second hour of It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. It's time for this week's in-depth interview with a special guest from the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome back. If you just joined us, I wanted to let you know this is a two-hour show in which we try to explore whether we have more in common than divides us. In the first hour of the show, we ask questions that matter, avoiding politics, instead focusing on issues that underlie politics and current events, issues that affect us all, young or old, locally and globally. And I go out on the street and get opinions from ordinary people on these important topics. In this, the second hour, we balance the creative with the intellectual by featuring in-depth interviews with local, national and international guests from the arts. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. It's all a question of balance. If you'd like more information about the show, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can hear podcasts of all previous shows there, both topics and guests. We've had some great topics and some wonderful arts guests. And you can connect with me on social media there also, should you wish. So again, that's itsaquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing internationally acclaimed artist William Kelly. Known for his use of space, colour and shape to create alluring, glowing paintings, William has studios in Florence in Italy and Florida in the US and has had many exhibitions of his art in both countries. His work is highly admired and sought after by private collectors, including British art historian Sister Wendy Beckett, world-renowned designer Adrian Vittadini, Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Mike Peters, Marchese di Frescobaldi of the 700-year-old Tuscan winemaking family, and Brian Johnson, the lead singer of AC/DC, who owns over 10 of William's paintings. Born in Cambridge, Massachusetts, William began drawing and painting as a young child. With art as his passion, he attended the University of Massachusetts to study art, but switched majors to history after becoming disillusioned with the department, however, still putting himself through college by painting portraits of fellow students. He went on to study for 4 years at the Museum of Fine Arts at Boston and for 2 years at the Lorenzo de' Medici Art Institute in Florence. Travelling widely through Europe and Asia, William drew inspiration from the varied cultures, channeling his enthusiasm into his art and moving his focus from portrait painting to landscape. Renowned art historian and author Sister Wendy Beckett states of William's art, "The work so rich, glowing, cheery, subtle, its colours and patterns so measured in their rhythm, its impact of serious joy so deep." Welcome to the show, William.
Thank you, Ruth. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I know painting and drawing have been a passion for you from early on. I'm wondering if you can remember the first piece of art that really drew you in and made you conscious of the power of imagery.
Well, it's that's a hard question. I do remember when I was in the sixth grade in Cambridge, there was a citywide contest for people from the sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. And I entered, I was fascinated by Walt Disney in those days, and I had a gift for likenesses, and when you're that age, you're 11 or 12, and you really haven't been taught, so I just was able to get people, faces, and so sort of as a joke, I did a couple of paintings of Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse, and I actually won first prize, and they were my first pastel drawings. So
so you're saying Disney would be one of your earliest inspirations that, you know, that made you aware of the power of imagery?
Absolutely. I mean, when you look back, and that was in the 50s, and to see the kind of imagery and the characters and that they did, it was fascinating to a little boy.
Yeah, absolutely. You went on to the University of Massachusetts intending to study art. What happened to change your direction at that time?
There was I started out studying art history, and then I had a couple of basic drawing and painting classes, and I found that there was not a lot of support from the teachers that I had at the time. And in fact, it's kind of ironic, they were sort of prejudiced at certain types. For example, when I was also an art major, I was playing football, and one of the teachers, he did not like football players. And I did the basic drawing classes where you go around the campus, you draw. As I mentioned, I drew a lot of people, and I drew scenes from outside. And then you go into class, and you review the work. There's no actual work in the studio for this particular class. It was all outside work. And at the end of the day, and I don't tell people, I haven't told too many people that have been buying my paintings recently, that I actually got a C in basic drawing.
So I think you're safe to reveal that now, considering your career.
But, well, there's two sides to that, because I told that story to a friend of mine at Spa, and he said, you should write the guy a letter and thank him, because that motivated me. I went and spoke to the person, and he said something to me which was complimentary, but at the time, it wasn't to him. And he said, well, you're not really an artist. You're more like Norman Rockwell. Well, I mean, I thought Norman Rockwell was pretty talented, and you know, he was on the cover of the May, but he was basically an illustrator, so that was a bad word back in the 60s. So, but that did motivate me to, number one, just work on my own. And I did, I'm interested in a lot of other things. I was interested in art history. I was interested in political science and European history and American history. So I switched the major, but I continued to work on my own, which I did for several years after that.
Yeah, it's interesting that teacher who was compartmentalizing people. It's like, oh, if you're into sports, you can't be into art. That seems ridiculous.
Well, it's also not, I'll finish the story with that because it has sort of a sad ending also. That was in 1964. And you fast forward to 1978. I was in Newburyport, Massachusetts, which had a growing art colony. It was next to Rockport, north of Rockport, which was a pretty famous art colony. And Newburyport was just beginning. And I had a little gallery where I did portraits, and I also took in work from other local artists on consignment, because I was physically at my studio every day doing portraits. And one day, it was in June of 78, obviously I've never forgotten it, a young woman came in, and I would be fairly quiet because I'd be working, and I'd say, you know, there were three little rooms. It was kind of a funky little place. So I told this woman, why don't you look around if you have any questions? There's several artists represented here. And so she was walking around, and she came up to me later and said, well, who did this painting? There was a painting of a South American woman, which I had done. And she says, well, I really like that. And I said, well, thank you. That's one of mine. And so I said, you're interested in art? And she said, I am. But I just had a little stoppage in my plan. I said, what happened? She says, well, I'm at the University of Massachusetts, and I was getting my Master of Fine Arts. And I just had my review. This was in June. She said, I just had my review 2 weeks ago. And you have to get an approval by all three teachers. And one of the teachers dissed me, basically. So I have to go back for summer school. Now, this was for a master's of fine art. So just out of the top of my head, I mentioned the teacher that I had 14 years. And she said, and she turned, she went like crazy. She said, you know him. And it was the same teacher. And the guy... And she said, he's absolutely the worst teacher, and he's got tenure or something. And it really kind of screwed her life up, because she had to spend another 3 months going back to summer school.
Right.
And I thought then, it's so critical. And I, you know, I have children and grandchildren, and I tell them it is so critical to make sure that if you're interested in art and you want to pursue it, and there are programs available in the school that you're in, you better make sure that the teachers you know, have an open mind, and they're not prejudiced in certain, you know, I have no idea why this particular teacher, I know why he didn't like me, but I had no idea what he had against this young woman who apparently, and then she showed me some of her portfolio, and she was very talented.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, as a teacher, you are in a position, especially at university level, of quite a lot of power. So if you have any kind of psychological, emotional issues going on, it's very easy you know, project them onto students, I would think, you know, if he was jealous or, I don't know, I'm imagining what might have, you know, spurred him on to behave like that. But at the very least, he was very narrow-minded.
I believe so. And over, you know, in the years following that, when I went to the school at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, which is a great school, arguably one of the best in America, and also the Medici Institute in Florence, there is a theme that most teachers have, and basically, you'll never get an A. You
know? Right, yeah.
They won't give you an A. If you get a B+, that's sort of what you shoot for, because their theory and their theme is basically, you can do better.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
As long as, you know, the teachers I had at the museum school and the teachers in Florence were absolutely incredible educators. And you wouldn't mind taking criticism, because it was all good criticism, and it helped you.
Yeah.
It helped go forward. But it's really an important thing.
Yeah.
I teach occasionally. I don't do it formally. I have classes at my studios in Italy and sometimes in Florida. And my rule is just to have fun. And my rule is there is no rules, you know, and particularly with oil painting, because you can really have a lot of fun and you can make mistakes, but you can fix them.
Yes, yeah. I know you had a teacher early on at college who told you not to paint for money, but to paint what you wanted to. How important was that advice for you?
Well, that was actually right after college. It was when I had my studio in Newburyport. Mm. And this was a fellow that was a former teacher. He was a German artist. He was his name was William Garms. And at the time, he was, you know, I was probably in my late 20s, and he was in his 60s. And he was a marvelous painter, draftsman, but he had gone into work, and he came over from Germany, and he was interesting. He went to the art school that Hitler flunked out of in Munich. And that guy was a character. He became a spy for the Americans in World War II and came over to America. And he worked for one of big illustration companies that does the ads for the New York Times for clothing, you know, men's suits and women. Mm-hmm. And he was very talented, but he hated doing that.
Mm.
And then at the end of the day, you know, he said he was pretty funny. That's when I started to drink, because I'd like to paint in a more relaxed, and I like to paint what I want to paint. But, you know, when you're working 8 or 9 hours a day, 5 or 6 days a week, doing something that you don't like in the field that you supposedly like, it was very frustrating to him.
Right. Yeah, a bit demoralizing. Yeah.
And he had said to me, you know, you have other... He was the one that started to break me away from portrait painting. Mm. And he said, you know, that's a skill, and you've developed it, but, for example, when I was at my studio, I would be doing... People would sit, and I would do portraits, and you'd get, like, $25 for charcoal or $50 for pastel. And he kind of said, you know, you have more talent than this.
Mm.
You know, I don't think you should be doing this for the rest of your life for $20 or $50, and you should do something else. If you're doing this to pay the rent, it's wrong, he said, for you, because you got other talents. You should be expanding your talents. You should be doing stuff that, you know, experimental. You should be going out painting the seascapes. You should be going out doing landscapes. And he was really, obviously, I've never forgotten. I still remember his name, and I remember the impact that he had.
Mm. So. Well, it just shows you the is kind of the opposite experience of the other person, how important it is, you know, to have positive mentors. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, internationally acclaimed artist, William Kelly. And I wanted to let you know you can view his paintings and find out more about him at williamkellygallery.com. And that's Kelly with an E, K-E-L-L-E-Y, williamkellygallery.com. We'll be back after these messages.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
About you in the rain.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, this is Jackie from Integrity Event Planning. Are you coordinating an event? Don't know how you'll get it all done? Stop sweating the small stuff. We plan everything from family events to fundraising and corporate events. Contact Integrity Event Planning for your next event. Check out our website, integrityeventplanning.com. Integrity, it's what sets us apart. With 16 years of experience, we negotiate with your bottom line and needs in mind. So sit back and relax and let us serve the champagne. We've got this.
For your next event, visit integrityeventplanning.com. That's integrityeventplanning.com.
Dream, baby, dream.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, acclaimed artist William Kelly. And again, his website is williamkellygallery.com, and that's Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y, williamkellygallery.com, if you would like to have a look at some of his beautiful paintings. And before the break, William, we were talking about how this teacher, I guess, came to your gallery and was encouraging you to move away from portrait painting and be more experimental. You have moved predominantly into landscape painting. So was it because of what he suggested, you know, that you should stretch yourself, or why do you think you've ended up focusing on landscape?
He was one of the major impetus, yes. But it took me a little while. His main thing was you should, if you're doing this to make money, you should stop doing it. Try doing something else, you know, go into, you know, because I have said you have a good personality, you can go into sales or something, and keep yourself free. That was his main thing, keep yourself free. So I did take his advice, and I sort of gave up going to that gallery, and I started to travel quite a bit. And then that was in the late 70s when I met him, and in the 80s, I was able to do some serious travel around the world, and I began to switch. I still, for example, I spent three different trips in the 80s to Bangkok, Thailand, and Japan, and that is a totally incredibly different culture. Mm. But I did do several portrait painting, but I started to switch from portraits to street scenes. That was sort of the, you know, I've had like several evolutions. One of the pure portraits, then to like the street scenes in Asia and Thailand, Japan, and then I started visiting London and Ireland, and I did a lot of pub scenes and again street scenes around Covent Garden and places like that. And then it was eventually following that I began to spend more time on the Gulf Coast of Florida in the early 90s, and I started experimenting with not necessarily land, but there are sea scenes, Gulf scenes, you know, sunsets, and I had a process of really adapting and learning about color, and I taught myself to put, I had a place on the beach, and I would put paper down and tape it down and do quick watercolors as the sun sets. Now, I know in California you have spectacular sunsets, and here in the Gulf of Mexico they are. And there's where I really learned about color, because when you watch the sunset, and more importantly, after it sets, you will see every color in the spectrum. And what I would do is I would do maybe five or six watercolors at a time, just, you know, running down. I had a seawall, and I had them taped. And as the sun set, because watercolors, you have to work fast, and you're not allowed to make any mistakes. And from those watercolors, I would develop these big canvases of the sky. I call them sky water scenes. And they were just, that's where I really had the breakthrough about accepting and really loving color. And then in the mid to late 90s, I began to go to Florence in 1997. That was the first year. And then that just, from there on, I mean, the colors in Tuscany, although I had a studio in Florence, I would go out into Tuscany, Chianti, and just marvel at the colors and the light. And I developed a theory, which I still use. And the theory is, in my paintings, you will see a lot of wild colors put together. But those colors exist in a 24-hour spectrum. Mm. They don't necessarily exist like at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But in particularly with olive trees, for example, in Tuscany, they will change color daily, during the day. Not necessarily. You'll see them silver at night. You'll see them pinkish. You'll see them blue. It's really an amazing phenomenon. Mm. And I have a lot of fun with that because basically when I'm doing my painting, it is, you know, one time, essentially. I'm painting it during the time, but it reflects basically a 24-hour color spectrum.
Mm. I mean, you use some beautifully vivid colors, you know, pink, purple trees, for example. So if I understand what you're saying is you really see these colors in the landscape at different times. And then what you do is you combine them in your paintings. So there may be a purple tree with a silver tree that may actually not appear together in real life. But at some point in the day, both those colors have been there. Is that right?
They are there during the day. But there's I think it was Cezanne that said this. It's a double reality. The double reality is what I see, or what the, not just me, what the landscape painter sees, and then what he feels.
Right, yeah.
So then, and then you put it down on the canvas, and it's really a double reality. It's a sight and a feeling kind of thing, and it's pretty cool.
Yes, yeah, I can understand that. And I'm also thinking that from that you get this emotional and energetic content that, you know, Kandinsky referred to it as the unseen, of painting the unseen as well as the seen. Is that something that informs your work?
That's basically the same thing Cezanne said. It's basically the unseen is what he feels, Kandinsky. And I'm a big fan of it. That's what he feels. You see something, you also feel something. There's a double reality, and your interpretation is what you put on the canvas.
Right, yeah. One of your gallery prospectuses is headed up the transforming power of color. How do you hope color will affect the viewers of your paintings?
Number one, I just hope that when somebody looks at the painting, that they get a feeling of warmth, of happiness, of maybe being there or wanting to be there. Most of the time, wanting to be there. It's like a vision. And it's a dream, and it's something that I hope hits them more than just the reality. Because, in fact, my paintings are more dreamlike than real.
Mm, yeah. Art historian Sister Wendy Beckett is a great admirer of your painting, stating, "Wonderful work, as profound a vision as one could want." For listeners who are not familiar with Sister Wendy, can you tell us a bit about her and how she came to admire your art?
Yeah, Sister Wendy Beckett, she's quite an individual. She's a character. She is a cloistered nun. She became a nun when she was like 16 or 17, and she was a teacher, but then she decided that she really wanted to be contemplative, and so she lives in a monastery, a Carmelite monastery, in the village of Quindindim in Norfolk, England.
Right.
And she was living this contemplative life, and she's very prolific. If you Google Sister Wendy Beckett, she probably has 25 or 30 books out. And in some circles, my teachers in Florence, for example, thought she was, without a doubt, the best art historian on the planet. And the teachers were kind of funny. They would say, because she can do it, she has the time to do it, and she's not biased.
Right, yeah.
Studies art and writes about it. Well, then what happened with her, back in the late 80s, the Tate and the National Museum needed, first of all, it was the National Museum in London. They needed somebody to kind of spruce up and get some marketing done. And someone suggested they use Sister Wendy because she's quite a television personality, which they didn't know at the time. They know she was a personality once she discusses the work.
Uh-huh.
So the gallery in London, I think it was 1988, 1989, they got her out, and basically she doesn't leave. But she did leave, and she did these remarkable videos. And she is, she's all about the beauty, the love, and of everything in paintings, but she's very knowledgeable, and she has an incredible background, and she can discuss this with anything. So anybody. In fact, once she was so successful on BBC, PBS in America got her, and there's a famous set of videos with the Bill Moyers, who is one of the PBS TV people, and she shows her humor, because in talking to Sister Wendy, Bill Moyers tries to get her, like, she would talk about nudity, and he would say, I don't know what his religious background, but he would say, you're a Catholic nun, and what do you know about nudity? And she said, well, Bill, I love God, and God made the body. He didn't make the clothes. So she did another. But then, later in this video, he goes back to that, because she starts talking about the sensuality of a painting. And he says, now, I don't know if I should, well, this is public anyway. Bill Moyers is saying, well, what, I mean, you're a cloistered nun, and you're a consecrated virgin. So what do you know about sexuality and sensuality? And she said, Bill, as I told you before, I love God, and he wouldn't give you a toy if he didn't want you to play with it. I thought it was great. But at any rate, she became aware of my work. I had, you know, every now and then you have these big breaks, and it's a very competitive world in art. And there was a gallery in New York back in 2000, Walter Wickheiser Gallery, who really liked my work. His father, Ralph Wickheiser, was a very accomplished painter, and he was also an educator. And Walter had been to Florence when he was younger, so he gave me a one-man show in Soho, which was huge in 2000. And he does advertising in Art News. And Art News is the biggest trade magazine, one of the biggest. And he put a full-page ad in of one of my paintings from Italy, and it was a Tuscan scene. And the gallery got a postcard from Sister Wendy Beckett, and said, I remember exactly what it said. It said, I would like to see more of William Kelly's work. It seems to have a lyric strength that is very moving. And when we got the postcard, I was at the gallery along with this New York critic that written my work, who liked my work, Garrett Henry. And Walter wasn't really familiar with Sister Wendy. And Garrett said, let me tell you something, Walter. He says, what do you think about me? And Walter says, well, you're big in New York. He said, she's big in the world. And then I started writing to her, and she's right off the bat, she said, we'll never meet because I don't see people, but I would send her things, and she made some amazing, over the years, some incredible comments. And then that was the push that, we had a sellout at the show, and we did several more in New York. And but, a lot of people in the art world respect her. And they know that, this isn't commercial. She just does this because she really liked the work. And in my particular field, there's a lot of different art fields. There's, all kinds of different contemporary paintings. I'm essentially a very, what's called a colorist. Mm-hmm. And I essentially paint landscapes, or not so much city scenes anymore. But that's, and for people that like that work, and someone like her is very important. In fact, when I was in your neighborhood, I was at a show in Palm Springs in 2003. And I had a couple of paintings, and I had some of the quotes. I typed up the quotes of Sister Wendy hanging next to the painting. And it was the Palm Springs International. It was a big fair, and there were a lot of people. And I had a couple of paintings there. One was a very a big painting from the Frescobaldi Winery in Florence. And it was big, and it was 6 by 7 feet. And a woman came by, and she was reading the quotes, and she said, do you have the originals? Which I did. And I had the original notes from Sister Wendy, who writes, my friend Brian Johnson says, it's Arabic. You can't read her handwriting. And she laughs about it.
Oh, that's funny.
We I talk to the woman, and then a few minutes later, an hour later, this big guy comes by and he says, well, my wife says, if you're good enough for Sister Wendy, you're good enough for us. So she was very influential, and that was one of the biggest sales in the show that year. So she's been very, it's good to have an unbiased, you know, that's the whole thing. You know, you can hire people to write reviews, and you can hire people to write things in your books and stuff, and that's very typical of the art business. But the people in the know, this was, you know, this was unsolicited praise. And in fact, 4 years later, that's when in 2006, my wife Susan got an email from a priest, and he says, I don't know who William Kelly is, and this is very unusual, but Sister Wendy, there are two priests that travel with her, and she has to go to Rome to do the audio for the Sistine Chapel, and then she's going to Bologna because she's studying some 6th century icons, and Florence is in the middle, and we were wondering if you and William would like to meet us.
Oh, wow.
And I said to Susan, you know what? I said, no, I want them to come to Florence. And at this point, she had been writing about me for 5 or 6 years, and a lot of my friends had said, well, you might not want that, because when I paint, I get a little excited. My language might not be the best. And they said, she's already called you spiritual son to Cezanne, and she thought, why are you doing this? I said, well, I wanted to see the work. So, in fact, we invited them to stay with us, and we, of course, we never met them, and Susan was, what did we do? We fortunately had a couple of extra bedrooms. So she came, to the studio, and in fact, that quote you said about the color, the tremendous impact of the changing color. What I was doing in Florence at the time, and I had sent her, we had taken a break and gone to China, and I was working on a massive painting of the Great Wall, and my sketches. As soon as we got in the car to pick her up, we had a friend with a van. She's very funny, and it's interesting because we'd never met. And she said, now, William, I have to tell you, I'm very apprehensive about looking at your new paintings because I so love the Tuscan. And I'm going, oh, my God. When she came to the studio, this was the first thing she saw. And it was hanging there, and it wasn't really done. But we went right to the studio, and she just looked at the painting and said, this is a tremendous, this is a beautiful painting. And I was kind of surprised because it's different than my other style.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. But I breathed a sigh of relief.
Well, it's really wonderful that she regards your work so highly. If you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, internationally acclaimed artist, William Kelly. We'll be back after these messages.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
About you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, babe, it just goes nowhere.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi,
Hi, this is Jackie from Integrity Event Planning. Are you coordinating an event? Don't know how you'll get it all done? Stop sweating the small stuff. We plan everything from family events to fundraising and corporate events. Contact Integrity Event Planning for your next event. Check out our website, integrityeventplanning.com. Integrity, it's what sets us apart. With 16 years of experience, we negotiate with your bottom line and needs in mind. So sit back and relax and let us serve the champagne. We've got this.
For your next event, visit integrityeventplanning.com. That's integrityeventplanning.com.
Dream, baby, dream.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, the artist William Kelly. And just to give you his website again, if you want to take a look at his beautiful work, it's williamkellygallery.com, and that's Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y, williamkellygallery.com. So before the break, we were talking about Sister Wendy Beckett coming to your studio, and I know you've had some other very interesting people who've come to your studio, and you have some high-profile people who collect your art, one of whom is Brian Johnson of AC/DC, who's a very serious collector of your paintings. How did he become aware of your work?
Well, I met Brian about 22 years ago. We were in Sarasota, and we were having a party, and we invited a couple of our friends. It was the 4th of July in Sarasota is actually a big weekend because we lived on the beach and they had boat races. So we had an outside party, and we invited a friend of ours, and he wanted to, who's another artist, sculptor, and he asked if he could bring two guests, two couples that had purchased some of his work, and one of the couples was Brian and his wife Brenda. And Brian and I just hit it off immediately. And I was not, quite frankly, that familiar with AC/DC. I'm sort of a Beatles and a Rolling Stones fan.
Uh-huh.
But he came to the party, and he just reminded me, I'm from the Boston area, and I had a lot of Irish musician friends. And he just reminded me of so many of my old friends. And we just became fast friends.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you play golf, and I hadn't played golf in a long time. We started playing a little golf, and he was, then he became interested in my work, and not initially. In fact, he said he didn't like, it's kind of funny, he didn't like a lot of my Irish pub scenes.
Uh-huh.
Being English, he wasn't, he said, I'm not interested in Irish pub scenes, trust me. I said, okay. But then when I started to go to Italy in the mid-90s, and I remember he liked, his mother is Italian.
Mm-hmm.
Brian's mother is from Rome, and she married his father, right after World War II. In fact, Brian and I found out we had a major connection, which is sort of like karma. His father and my father were both at the Anzio invasion in World War II.
Wow.
And that was in February of 1944. And it's actually when my father was there when I was born. Now, he was with the American Navy, and they were bringing supplies up from Naples to Anzio. And the physical part of Anzio, a lot of people don't, it got lost in the shuttle with Normandy, which was 5 months later. But Anzio was just as brutal, and it was almost the same geography in Italy as, different from France, but it had the high banks, and the Germans were there. So the British soldiers and the American Navy were kind of together.
Mm.
So we thought that was an amazing coincidence. So we call ourselves the Sons of Anzio. That was our bond. But Brian started to get really into my work when I went to Italy, and I think the first painting he bought was a painting I did in Venice, and then he became a serious collector. He collects other artists, but he, because he loves art, and he was at my studio in Florida. I said an interesting thing, because we always talk about, there's a lot of discussion between art and music. For example, when I paint, I have to have, you know, I have Bocelli or, you know, sort of soft music, when Italian music, or even the Rod Stewart music, or Dean Martin, you know, slow music. Uh-huh. And then at the end of the day, I'll play, Brian has given me a lot of AC/DC, I'll play AC/DC as the day goes on, you know, or, you know, Beatle music. Uh-huh. Anyway, he was at my studio one day, and he just said, can I, you know, I said, as long as you don't bother me, because I don't go to your studio. And he was just sitting there, and I was starting a painting, and he said, you know, this is exactly what I do, except you do it, it's a little more complex than you do, but you have the white canvas, and I have the white sheet of paper.
Right.
And what do you put on there? Like, he writes songs, and I do paintings. And it was an interesting comparison. And he said, you have, I mean, you have stuff in your head that makes all these, and it's the same with me. I mean, I have these crazy words, and I try and put them together. And I also think, and probably different from you, you're thinking of how you put the forms and the, you know, the harmony together. I also think about how these words, the lyrics that would work with tunes.
Right.
So it was, and
yeah,
it's you can get into a major discussion with that, because there's a great book called The Yellow House by a British author named Martin Gayford, and he talks about Gauguin and Van Gogh when they lived together for a short time in Arles. They were assigned numbers to, like, the colors, the music notes. They say, like, yellow represents a high note, you know, and blue is a softer note, and they really would get it. So it's been an ongoing discussion throughout history, the combination of art and music. And then over the years, Brian has just bought, he has two homes, and I think last year he bought his 18th painting.
Wow, gosh.
And
I understand he recently finally persuaded you to part with a painting that he'd wanted for years. Could you tell us a bit about that and what made you finally give a painting up?
Well, yeah, that's an old... basically, I gave it up because he's a good friend. He's probably the only one that I would sell the painting to, other than maybe one of the Beatles. The painting is of the Beatles, and I... This goes back to what we started talking about earlier. When I was in my portrait phase in Newburyport, Massachusetts, this was like 1977, I wanted to do, and I'd spent a lot of time every day doing one person at a time, as they sit for you. So I needed to do a composition with more than one face. And I was a big Beatles fan, and I saw the Sgt. Pepper album, and the inside cover had the four of them. But I was studying... More, I was a big Rembrandt fan back then, and my understanding of Rembrandt's paintings were he used a lot of the subdued, the sienna colors, and he didn't make a lot of the reds and the yellows. His paintings were a little darker, with very strong highlights, and that's what I understood at the time. I've since sort of changed my mind, but basically, I was doing the four Beatle faces as more subdued coloring, you know, and then I would paint the uniforms at night in kind of a wild, you know, wild color. But during the day, I'd do the portraits. And I always loved the painting. And I just, you know, as I said, it was 1977. In fact, in the 80s, I made a lithograph of it that was very popular. But I kept the original. And Brian, over the years, had said, you know, I really like this painting. And I said, well, I'm not selling it, you know. And then finally... last year, you know, he's like, he's very, come on, Billy, we got to talk about this, you know. All right. So then we have to negotiate, which I don't like doing, you know, like, I don't like selling to friends. I'd rather have galleries do it. You know, I don't like negotiating.
Yeah.
But with Brian, it was fun. I enjoyed it. So we finally made an agreement, and it was subject to him. You know, he was building this pub in his house. He made sure he wanted to have a fit. It's there now, and it's like, you know, as a painter, there's always this feeling. I really enjoy when I go into somebody's home to see my work, because most of the time I see it in a studio or in a gallery. So when I see it in somebody's home, and let me tell you, that painting of the Beatles in Brian's pub is like the absolute perfect place for it.
Yeah.
It just, you know, it's classic.
I can imagine. And I mean, that's part of the hard part of being an artist, is that you have to give up what you've created. You know, I mean, you can take, you know, like you say, lithographs or have prints of it, but it's never the same as the original. So it's that's a hard process, I imagine, to let go of something you put so much energy into.
Well, it is hard, but it's a little easier for me because my wife Susan is very opinionated, and she'll be in my studio and she'll see something and she'll write on a piece of paper and she writes NFS. And at first, when she did this, I said, what does that mean? She says, not for sale.
Wow. That's the highest admiration of your painting.
Yeah, she says, that's ours. That's not going anywhere.
Oh, that's great. I wanted to ask you, all art is about communication. In representational art, obviously, the artist is trying to communicate with an audience the reality of a certain scene in whatever way. I'm wondering what you're trying to convey through your art beyond the subject itself, if anything.
Well, if the subject is a landscape, that's a very good question. If it's a portrait, you're trying to get your impression of the person and get something. In portraits, you try and get something from their eyes. That's
right.
The key.
Yeah.
You really have to get the sense of the person, at least I do, from their eyes. So what I'm trying to get is how I look at them and how I think they feel while they're actually sitting for me. If it's a landscape, I think it goes back to, it's not so much what, I'm basically sharing my feeling of what I see. And sometimes, as I'm talking to you, I'm looking at one of my newer paintings from Tuscany, which is a grape, a vineyard, but I exaggerated the grapes. I mean, the grapes are like almost portraits in themselves.
Yeah.
They're way bigger than that they are in real life. But with the background, with the balance of the bay, it kind of works. But that's just a feeling that I have, and it's probably because when I'm in Tuscany, I drink a lot of wine. I don't know why I wanted to make, I don't really know why I wanted to make them that big, but the other side of it is a couple of my artist friends in Florence said, basically, you're going back, sometimes you go back to your roots, because when I had the concept to do this, it was sort of to have fun, to exaggerate it, and be totally unrealistic. However, when I started doing the actual implementation of painting, it was sort of a little difficult because all these grapes, it's like doing little portraits.
Yeah, each grape.
A million of them.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know...
It's all about feeling. It's all about spirit. You know, that's the key. That's what I try to communicate. I mean, this is what I felt when I did this. But if I'm doing your portrait, it's more of what I feel you're feeling.
Right, so yeah.
There's distinction. That ultimate sharing that you were talking about. That's it there.
Yeah. Well, I think also that there's definitely artists have a different way of perceiving the world. I mean, they're paying more attention to the visual aspects of life. And so I think that that's one thing that is really interesting when you are experiencing someone's art, is you're being drawn into something that perhaps you haven't noticed. You know, we take, obviously, you know, things in when we go into places, but we don't look at it in the same way as an artist, I don't think. And so looking at a painting is a way of experiencing the world in that heightened visual way, becoming more aware of everything around us, I think.
I agree.
Deep thought there. We're coming towards the end of the show, but I wanted to ask you briefly how you decide what scene to paint. Obviously, you live in two beautiful places, but you know how you choose what you want to paint, and then what the process is, you know, from that point to finishing it.
Well, it goes on what you were just saying, that an artist sees something different. We're going back to Florence in a couple of weeks, and every time I go back, whether it's the spring or the fall, when I first get there, I have a friend from England, David Tweed, who's been a driver in Florence for years, and he does tour. He'll take me out, and he'll and I'll say, look, I need to go over to this area, and then I'll just look. And I see things, and I have like a small easel. It's called the French easel. It's like a briefcase that opens up. It was invented in 1860, and it's never been improved. It's a great tool, and you can do it. And so what I'll do, for example, last year it was these grapes, and I went out, and I was in a winery, the Caparzo Winery in Montalcino, and I set up, and I started just laying down colors. But there's so many, my problem is, there's so many vistas.
Mm.
So what I have to do is I have to limit myself. I have to concentrate on what I really want to achieve in this particular area.
Yes.
So that's the difficult part for me.
Yeah.
I have to sit, I have to look. But the key is getting outside. You have to, for me, I have to be outside. The French called it in plein air. But I really need to do that. And then I'll end up doing... you know, as many, I never really finish. You know, I'll end up doing 12, 13, depending on the size of the painting. And in fact, before we go back to Florence this year, I'm going to go back to Ireland. We haven't been there in 20 years. And when I used to go there, as I said earlier, I just did a lot of the street scenes and the pub scenes. And I have a lot of my, you know, my family's artists. They always said, well, you know, it's time to go home and paint your own country. So this time, I'm going around and just, I'm going to be painting landscapes. I'm going to start them and then finish them in my studio in Florence. It'll be the first time in several years that I'll be doing non-Tuscan paintings.
Right.
My Irish.
Yeah. Well, I wish you all the very best with that. Unfortunately, we have come to the end of the show, but thank you so much for coming on and talking about your work.
Thanks for having me. I've enjoyed the conversation. You asked some very good questions.
Oh, thank you. And I want to let listeners know again that if you want more information about William's work or to view his paintings, you can go to his website, williamkellygallery.com. And that's Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y, so williamkellygallery.com. It's really beautiful work, so I recommend going and having a look. I also wanted to remind you again about the show's website. It's a question of balance.com. I podcast all the shows there, so if you enjoy this interview and you want to listen again or you want to tell friends about it, you can find it at the website. It's a question of balance.com. And also my previous guests and topic discussions with people on the street. So that's itsaquestionofbalance.com. I look forward to seeing you next week.